This episode of Creativity in Captivity is sponsored by the Curtis Theater in Brea, California, presenting Don Reed's The Never Too Late Show on Saturday, May 11th. Tickets are available at the Curtis Theater website. Get ready for insight and inspiration on the creative process from an array of artists, writers, and visionaries on May 9th, when Season 7 of Creativity in Captivity kicks off. In the meantime, please enjoy over 150 episodes hosted by Pat Hazel with a stable of creative guests in our listening lounge at creativityincaptivity.fun.
This is Creativity in Captivity. I'm Pat Hazel. My guest today is a modern vaudevillian with a diverse theatrical toolkit. He is an animated physical comedian, a skilled juggler, and a world-class sleight-of-hand artist. He toured the world in The Illusionist 1903 as the front half of Charlie Fry and Company. He's also the author of Charlie Fry's Slightly Absurd. Stay tuned for the clever conjurer and engaging eccentric, Charlie Fry.
That spark of electricity, a skipping stone that sets you free, you're captive to a mystery, the curse of creativity.
Wow, who wrote that? Jeez.
You are a person who, when I first heard of you, which was many, many years ago, it was always people I respected that said, have you seen Charlie Fry? So I kind of want to be sure that everybody knows about Charlie Fry.
That's awful nice. Yeah, we do go back a ways.
Well, you're one of the hardest working guys, but also you have a real sense of theater. And I know you started young. You grew up with clowns in your family. Am I right about that?
Yes, yeah.
Tell me about those early days.
Well, my father was a clown, my grandfather was a clown, and my mother was ashamed. That's pretty much it. So I grew up doing parades and the kind of things they had in the South, company picnics, witch burnings, book burning festivals, those kind of things.
Those used to be so much more popular than now, although they're coming back.
They are, yeah. My grandfather, he had a 1926 Model T, and it had a hidden driver. So it looked like there was no driver in the car, and he was a tramp clown walking in front of it with a steering wheel and a road map. And my father would chase him. He was dressed as a Keystone cop, and I was a little Keystone cop trying to keep up on a unicycle. And parade season was the busiest season. It was kind of the family side hustle, but Grandpa would fill my head with stories about when he was in vaudeville and burlesque. And he was always a semi-professional. Maybe he was professional in his younger days, and before vaudeville died.
And what was his skill set besides clowning?
Well, creating that car was pretty darn amazing. That was a heck of an invention, a driverless car. People thought it was remote control back then in the 60s and stuff. And it was actually just a little guy that was hidden inside the car, peeking through what looked like the seat. He was peeking through kind of a two-way mirror and driving it. He also taught me a little bit of sleight of hand. It was okay to teach a seven-year-old cigarette tricks in the 60s in North Carolina. It was perfectly acceptable. And I used to secondhand smoke a pack a day back then. When we would go to parades, and we'd drive for hours in the van, and we'd be playing cards and the cigarette fog inside the car. And I remember Grandpa always had a little bottle of vodka there, and I asked what that was, and he said it was to remove his makeup. And he actually took his makeup off with vodka one time rather than to tell me that's actually what it was.
So his work was mostly outdoors?
Yeah. In his earlier days, he would have been doing vaudeville indoors, but then later, yeah, it was mostly parades and maybe a horse show, company picnic, that kind of thing.
At what age did you first take the stage?
Actual stage would have been talent shows in school. I think I juggled on stage for the first time when I was maybe 12 and a talent show. So that was the first taste of actual boards under my feet. But I'm sure like you, we grew up also doing kids' parties and just about anything where you could get yourself booked and hired, just anything and everything. Looking through those old magic catalogs where you see Nightclub Dove Vanish and all that stuff, and the dapper looking magician with a goatee and a beautiful assistant. And you just go, wow, you know, I want to work nightclubs some days in those far off exotic places like Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Where are these nightclubs at? And you see all those old movies, the MGM musicals. Oh, let's do a show. And you go, wow, wow, where are these shows? I want to be in those shows.
I used to leaf through those Magic catalogs, and they varied from Magic Inc. in Chicago to the Tannen's catalog in New York. And the illustrations cracked me up because they would show a wizard with a pointed hat, and he'd have a handful of fire that he was throwing out of a paper bag. And that would make me fantasize walking into the lunchroom and being able to sling a fireball out over everybody's head. You thought about all these faraway places, and did you at that time ever imagine playing Broadway or touring the world and being a part of a show like The Illusionists?
Oh, gosh, no. We lived in New York. After the circus, I moved to New York and worked the streets there. And Broadway was off limits. That was for musical theater. That's for the greatest of the greats, in my opinion. That's not a skill set people have that can act, sing, and dance. And it's like an American opera. It's where all the greatest elements come together, from set design to lyricists to musicians to actors. It's just such a wonderful thing. And that, I just felt like, well, how many opportunities are there for a vaudeville? See, I grew up not knowing vaudeville died, you know?
Yeah. I don't think you've got the memo yet.
Yeah. I didn't find out until it was too late, and I was already heading down this path. But when we were living in New York, Sugar Babies was big then, and Michael Davis was having a big go of it on Broadway, and Ron Lucas. So there was actually a chance, a vaudeville chance there for an act to actually go out in a show. And when Will Rogers Follies came along, Vince Bruce was in that. He did an act spot. So now and then there were rare opportunities. And the Sugar Babies touring company with Rip Taylor, we did that in California. And they said if they were going to do another version of Sugar Babies, I think it was going to be called Scandals. And we were set for that. They wanted us for that. We were perfect for it. But then the producer died, which I thought was very unprofessional. So that didn't happen. But then The Illusionists came along and we had toured with that. And finally getting to play Broadway, the Palace of all places, too, the Palace. We would open for Liza Minnelli. My good friend Liza Minnelli told me not to name drop because it's so tacky. So I said, Liza, I won't do that.
You have to quote her at least, right?
Well, here's the quote. She said, Mama would have loved your act. That was enough for us to keep us going. All the snarky comments in the world can't wash that away. So she was just wonderful. And we opened for her and became good friends. She had seen us downtown in Vegas in a show we were doing and asked us to open for her. And she was just great. The show business stories and to watch her from the wings every night. And Francis Brunn, a great juggler, great friend of ours, probably the greatest juggler. Francis Brunn was just the greatest. He used to open for her mom. He opened for Judy Garland. And he used to keep a little swatch of her fabric in his makeup case. So at the palace, in the lobby, in a display case, they had a program of Judy Garland at the palace. And there was Francis's name on it. And here we were following in his footsteps. And I knew I was following in his footsteps. And at one point, Liza wanted to do Minnelli's Two a Day. And we came close to doing that. We got the acts together. It was going to be five acts in the beginning of the show. And then she would be the rest of the show. And so it was tailored somewhat like her mom's fantastic comeback at the palace in the 60s, where she had an act called Bubbles, a tap dance act. And she would do Me and My Shadow with Bubbles, I believe, John Bubbles. And then Francis would do his juggling act. And so that was, she was going to use her dad, Vincent Minnelli's set designs. And she opened an office in New York. And so that came close. But then she did Victor Victoria, and that kind of screwed up her voice. And then she had a few health issues. So it never happened. But I never had my hopes up because that just seemed too good to be true. And I've been kicked in the groin so many times in show business that we don't count on anything until the check clears.
Which, by the way, that could be an act in itself, the kick in the groin act. But you're bringing up a very interesting thing. And again, I watched some of that early stuff. I watched W.C. Fields in movies and things. But there was an era where the specialty act was the way to travel the country. The Orpheum circuit and some of those places where vaudeville was king, you needed an act and it had to be tight and fast and funny and furious, unless you were a specialty singer. But those variety acts pre-television were the thing where people went and where they would spend the day watching act after act after act.
What a great, great era that must have been to be able to see the Three Keatons on stage and W.C. Fields yeah, it just must have been wonderful. I think he said the only act he couldn't follow were the Marx Brothers, because he usually killed everywhere he went, but he said he had never seen so much nepotism and, was it hilarity in one act? And so he said he hurt his arm. That was the one act he couldn't follow. But can you imagine seeing that? So when we played the Palace, and one of the old stagehands, Bobby, he was the oldest stagehand on Broadway, and he retired after that show, after The Illusionist. He was already scheduled for retirement, but when we first got there, I remember the producer telling us, well, you can't come in early like you always do in practice before the show. You can't lift your own props on stage. It's union. There's all these rules, blah, 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 blah. As soon as we got there and met Bobby and his son, who was also a big stage tech on Broadway, the whole family is, I had the run of the joint. I could come in. I could practice beforehand. I stayed out of everybody's way, but they were so nice to it. I think some of the other acts, maybe there were a couple of egos in there that they didn't warm up to. You don't want to piss off the stage crew. People don't realize how important that is. But we just had such a good experience there. We did a ton of shows, and I was so worn out. We did a lot of spots in the show, and our work is more physical than most people, because it's manipulation magic, it's juggling, I did a close-up magic spot in the show that was really technical, but it's work, it's maximum effort.
Your skill set is really extraordinary. I mean, you have an amazing amount of talent, but also you're doing some difficult tricks, even if they don't know it, if they don't understand the juggling or understand the magic. This is not something AI is going to be able to replace you too quickly.
Yeah, there's no artificial intelligence in our act. There's no intelligence in our act, actually.
There you go. Right. But let's just focus on what your talent is, because your comedy is in this area where your physicality and your facial expressions and the relationship between you and your wife, she plays the greatest, somewhat disgruntled, uninterested, unenthusiastic assistant, because you seem like the show-off front man and she's got other things to do. Let's just talk about how that relationship developed, because you met in the circus, is that right?
Yeah, and it's kind of classic comedy. In the circus, I was, you know, a clown and a juggler, and I had probably 11 spots in the show, and Sherry was an aerialist, and she came from a ballet background. In New York, they had auditions for like 600 girls, and they hired two, and Sherry was one of them. And the other girl didn't last 2 weeks. And when Sherry was hired, she didn't even know she had to do aerial work. And she telegrammed her parents, I think where they were in Europe at the time. She said, I've joined the circus. We'll talk later.
That's a good short telegram to get.
Yeah. We met there, and we were really good friends. And she didn't know what I looked like outside of makeup, because during the day we had a number together that I would help her in, but at night she would come to the clown car on the train and hang out with friends and stuff, and I wouldn't even talk to her. She didn't know who I was. And then one night I said, oh, I'm the guy that helps you every day. We got to be really good friends, and the rest is show business history. So when I first branched out after the circus, I had a great partner, Sean Emery. We worked together in the circus, and then we worked the streets together, and then we went separate ways, did our own separate acts. And my first act was solo in the casino. It was still a clown act, but it was like an 11-minute juggling act, extended version of what I did in the circus. I used to do the act right before the show started. We called it the blow-off. As the people are coming in for the first 20 minutes, there were clown gags all around the track in the circus as people are coming in. And then the last 5 minutes, it was just me in ring one, working the audience, really trying to whip them into a frenzy. And then the whistle blows, the lights go out, and the circus starts. So that started as like a 5 or 6 minute routine, and then I expanded it into a stage routine. And then when we first got our first job in Vegas, my first job with that clown routine was at Harvey's in Lake Tahoe. And I remember one of the shows started at 2 a.m. And it was a show with a handful of dancers and a singer and me. And I actually kind of got a following amongst the rednecks up there and stuff. I remember Copperfield seeing us there. He came across the street and had different people. And
yeah, I just want to step back to the circus for a second. You were traveling by train on all that touring?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did 3 years on the road, and then they asked me to be advance man. So for the next year, I did advance work, where I would go ahead of the circus and do TV or radio or school shows or anything.
Right. Essentially to promote the circus is coming to town, right?
Right, right. Yeah. And it must have worked because they kept hiring me. So I flew all over the country doing that. Mr. Feld had asked me to do that for the third year when it was contract time. And I said, I'm not going to stay with the show, but we talked about advance. And so that's what I did.
And then you moved to Las Vegas at some point there. What time of your life was that? How old were you?
Well, first was New York. So I was in Clown College 79. So 80, 81, and 82 on the road. 83, advance and living in New York. 84, Tahoe. 85, moving to Vegas. We had an agent at seen us in Tahoe, told us to come to Vegas. We got to Vegas and he goes, and you are? But then we were here. And so the first show we got, I was still working in clown makeup, but then Sherry and I were starting to work together on stage. She was a showgirl and I was a clown. And George Carl came to the show, the greatest clown. And we became fast friends right away through a mutual friend from the circus. And he threw my clown costume into the trash. He said, you don't work like that anymore. You work like this. And he gave me his costume, which fit terribly because he was a lot littler than I am. But I did a showcase downtown, Sherry and I. And George, I think, was the only one laughing in the show. But he convinced me, yeah, you can still be a clown without all the motley. Because really, that's only appropriate in the circus. Sometimes in America, sadly, clowning gets a bad rap. It's scary. There's so many scary clowns in the media. And a lot of people don't even know what a good clown is, sadly. But George was a great clown, and he convinced me that I could still be a clown without the makeup. He would show us old videos of he and his wife. She was like a Hollywood blonde, and he was a little funny guy. And we would work on gags, and it slowly took shape. Sherry knew she could never just be a straight assistant. She just couldn't do it. And I'm just kind of a hapless character. With each show, her attitude got worse, and it makes me sympathetic on stage. You know, you feel for the guy. He's working like his life depends on it because his life depends on it. It's an act about a guy trying to do an act. He's getting no help from his own lack of skill. His wife isn't helping him, and hopefully he triumphs in the end and pulls off all the major tricks and hopefully brings the house down on a good night.
In there, there's a lot of character choices. You have a very strong central character who is fighting for his life every night.
He's right out the Keaton Chaplin playbook. The little guy against all odds, trying to make good, trying to impress his wife, trying to keep his wife, who doesn't give a darn.
And how did you come up with the name Charlie Fry and Company? Was that something your wife liked not having her name in it, or it just was a funny nod to the idea of a bigger company that wasn't there, or what?
No, people just called us that. First, we just kind of used our own names, and they just called us Charlie Fry and Company all the time. Michael Davis had a good idea. He was like, Fred Allen's act used to be Fred Allen and his missus, and he worked solo, but he was a juggler.
That was like Ricky Jay and his 52 assistants referred to his deck of cards.
Yeah, so Charlie Fry and his missus is funny because it's a play on my missus and as a juggler and missus. But it's too clever.
Right.
It's too clever. Everybody just called us Charlie Fry and Company, Charlie Fry and Company. And Sherry doesn't have an ego about this stuff at all. When we shot the pictures for The Illusionist, she just didn't even care. She's like, we don't even know if we're going to stay with this for more than a week or two. We kind of put our foot down with the producer right away. We said, look, we have the rights of approval on everything we do, whether it's the act, our costumes, our music, everything. We're not dying to be part of the show. You called us. We know we're perfect for it. As we did all their versions, but especially the one that was around 1903 or the turn of century one. We knew we were right. But we also knew we weren't begging for it. And then after the first show, the producer was our best friend and everything was good and all was fine. But in the beginning, I remember Sherry going, look, I don't need to get all dressed up for this. I don't have to be on the poster. She's the least egotistical person in show business. Her mom was a theater director. Her brother is a classical musician. He teaches at UNLV and plays for all the big stars. Her sister is a singer and a cantor. So Sherry grew up around show business. And in ballet, you can always be better. They're always browbeating into you. You don't get a big ego. That just gets in your way. It stops you from growing. It stops you from learning.
Ballet is about discipline and about perfection. There's a lot that goes into that.
Even Baryshnikov says perfection is unachievable. That's Baryshnikov. She never had her head upper rear, though she's very limber. So there's a lot of magicians, as you know, they are egotistical. I think it's all those old posters, all those great old posters, the great this and the great that. Jugglers don't entertain that same delusion that they're going to be world famous, because the most famous juggler was William Claude Dukenfeld. Who knows him, you know, except us.
Yeah, there you go. A ballerina that marries a clown is already humble.
So true.
You call yourself a professional eccentric in some places. And when did you start to embrace the eccentricity?
An eccentric in vaudeville, it was a type of performance, basically a stage clown, guy that dresses a little funny. Usually they were eccentric dancers like Buddy Ebsen, Ray Bolger, Joey Brown, and they were great. They usually had a great skill set, but they performed it in a comedic way, like W.C. Fields' juggling act. An eccentric character, Avner the Eccentric. He doesn't call himself Avner the Clown, he calls Avner the Eccentric. So an eccentric was a style of performer in vaudeville.
I see. It's just not an unconventional, slightly strange, like the word meant a little bit more.
Yeah, it's an unconventional approach to what you're doing. They weren't the standard tap dancer. They were the tap dancer in the baggy pants with great moves, but really limber and comedic in their performance. I think of an eccentric as a stage clown, basically. Somebody that dresses a little clowny, but they not the big red nose.
I gotcha. You have an uncanny ability to create routines. This kind of goes back to some things I read in your book about cardinal rules of don't bore anybody, don't leave any dead time. But you think so much about every moment and every prop and how they interact. And I really enjoyed over the, I'll call it the pandemic, you created a character called The Great Quarantine, where you were doing routines regularly on Facebook. One trick went into the next, went into a gag, and then there was a payoff. This is how you think when developing your act, I imagine.
Yeah, I think Dana Daniels wrote it. He said, I see you're doing your one-man show 2 minutes at a time. That's basically what he did. Yeah, when the shutdown first happened, and I was practicing, I practice every day. I'll be practicing in a minute. I'm practicing as we speak. I'm rolling a ball around my fingers. Sherry filmed it, and she just put it up. And the next day, I was practicing, and I was just in my robe. And she filmed that, and she put it up. And then somebody wrote and said, oh, I can't wait till tomorrow. I went, tomorrow? Really? And I go, well, okay, I'll think of something. I'll do something tomorrow. So I did something the next day, and then the next day. And then people wrote, and they're watching it with their kids, and they're looking forward to it. And it's keeping the kids from bouncing off the walls. And go, okay, well, let's see. And then I go, I wonder if I could do a month, you know, every day for a month. And we had criteria from the get-go. It had to be fast, silent, so that our friends in England and Australia and New Zealand could appreciate it. I didn't want to do any talking bits. And that's one of my fortes, it's working silent. I couldn't do anything from the act. I didn't want to burn the act material because I knew some people are going to be shopping, not just watching for entertainment, but they're watching for bits they're going to do. And now and then someone would reach out and go, do you mind if I do a routine that you did? And I'd say, sure, if they came about it the right way, yeah, run with it. And a lot of stuff I had worked on over the years and things, and thought, well, I'll see if I can do 30 days. And Sherry also said, and buy nothing new, only what you've got. And I think limitations foster creativity. It'd be easy to just go through a magic catalog, order something, and do it. When you've run out of material and you go to the closet and you go, okay, what haven't I done? What don't I have work on? And I've always kept journals. I think I'm on number 82 now, where I've always written down all my ideas, everything I've worked on, every bit, every routine. So I'm mining those for ideas. So every day for 30 days, great. And then the pandemic will be over, but it wasn't over. So then it was like, can we do another month? And I'd hit the wall so many times. I go, well, yeah, okay. So, and then it was 60 days straight. And then the pandemic still didn't stop. So then it was like, okay, well, now we'll do one a week for a while. But this time, now I'll be back in my costume. I'll no longer be the Great Quarantini. I'll get out of the robe. I'll set it to music a little bit better. It won't just be Sherry filming it with the camera. I'll set up a camera and I'll add some sound effects. And if I can time it out with the music, great. And a lot of times I'd work on a bit and Sherry'd say, what are you working on? I said, I'm working on something with a nail. And she'd look up music that would have something to do with a nail.
Yeah, fun though, that you're building an exercise. You're flexing your muscle through all of that, almost the way a columnist has to write a column every day, every week, just to have a routine of being creative in one fashion or another is a discipline to keep your muscle flexed. And it seems like you find a lot of outlets to do that.
Yeah, creativity is a muscle that has to be flexed. 140 videos later, and now and then I'll still put up something. We'll rerun things that, look, if I don't remember doing it 3 years ago, I don't think people remember seeing it back then. So now we can rerun them.
Let me explore the comment where you talked about working silently, because I know what that means. It means that you've got an act that can work internationally. Does that create any additional challenges for you?
Oh, absolutely. I've always loved silent material and I love working silent. But when we do a longer show, we'll open with the silent manipulation, comedy manipulation for 9 minutes. And then it'll be a half hour of talking material and still physical comedy and comedy with Sherry. And then the last part will be the juggling act, the 11-minute juggling act. So when you talk, you can do more time. It's much easier to do a 45-minute show verbal than it is silent. If you're working silent, yep, you can work all over the world. I guess we're probably further traveled than any other act that I know. We were in China a couple months ago, and so we have no language barrier, so we can work anywhere.
That allowed you to be in television appearances over 20 countries and guesting on the world's top shows everywhere, which is something, a consideration. I know that I was a talk comedy act and I barely went out of the country. I went to Vancouver and to London and a couple of places, but for the most part, there's not a way for me to survive without talking.
Yeah. In America, it's usually the time. We need a 45-minute show. We need an hour show. We need an hour 10. And for corporate things, comics rule. It's just so practical. You can just walk out with a mic and do it. With a silent act like ours, well, I need a sound man and lights and decent lighting and a wing to come in and out of.
Yeah, I remember hiring you once to be an opening act for me at a corporate event. And they have the barest of a platform stage. You end up having to go up the stairs and behind some pipe and drape. And that can be complicated when you're used to working proper proscenium theaters and having all that support theatrically.
And we've done more than our share of that. And it's okay if it's just a one-off and you just do it and you just grin and bear it. And George Carl used to say, be able to work on a matchbook. And we certainly can. We can scale it up for a 40-foot proscenium, 30-meter across stage, or I can do the parlor show in a restaurant, for Pete's sake. It looks best when it has some theatrical trappings of some sort.
You mentioned George Carl, who was one of the great physical comics, and his work with a top hat and a harmonica and a microphone and a stand. It packed small, but it played so big.
Yeah, I'm looking at his hat right now. It's sitting across from me on a hat rack. We have his costume, and mostly, more than anything, I had his friendship. We were family. I think it took somebody like him to tell me to throw away my clown costume, because I wouldn't have listened to anybody else. I was very stubborn and strong-headed on that. I'd been clowning my whole life.
Well, you're an unmasked clown. In some way, I know there's humanity in all of it. We've talked to Stefan Haves and some other folks that are clown whisperers that direct folks and work with them on their act, but I worked with some folks like Frank Ferrante, who sometimes does Groucho. And sometimes those things are important for character, but many times it's really the human condition that we're interested in. So as you mentioned with Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton, sometimes they had maybe a slightly eccentric costume, but otherwise we were really seeing who they were.
It's all about the humanity. Emmett Kelly said 90% of his clowning was done with his eyes. And a good clown, that does come across. A bad clown, it's just a over-the-top costume and everything. But a real clown, you can feel it. It's just right. It's just a style. It's a style of comedy. But it's a very artistic style. And it's rare that you get to come across it and see it at its best.
Well, given your mention of communicating through the eyes, the value of facial expressions on stage performer is one of the great tools. And I know that you faced the challenge sometime after I had met you where you were stricken with a bout of Bell's palsy for quite a while.
I'm Chaplin on the left and Keaton on the right. Yeah, it still is not as mobile as I would like it to be. It's been like that since 2007.
Wow. I had a playwright on here. I don't know if you know Sarah Rule, but Sarah had been told when she got Bell's palsy at the birth of her twins that 90% of Bell's palsy patients experience a full recovery. Well, she was not one of those people. She's one of the 10%. As a person putting on Broadway shows, really had to dig deep to understand what a smile was, what an important and vital form of communication smiling is, because other people, they look at you and they think, oh, does she not like me? And I'm talking about off stage. But for your act, as much as you had maybe a pattern of what you were doing, for you in the beginning of doing your act with that change in expression, where you really were helpless on one side of your face, did you have to change your routining or change your mindset at all?
No, not a bit. And mine was done by an injury. Mine was done by taking a 2-inch ball out of my mouth and my jaw popped. It was a late show in Athens and my jaw popped. And then that night, Sherry said, your eye looks weird. And I went, well, it's just, I'm tired. Yeah, I noticed after I practice a lot, sometimes I get a little sleepy eye or something after juggling for 2 hours. And then one of the kids in the show said, your eye looks fake. And so I got home and I looked and I immediately called a neurosurgeon friend of ours back in Vegas. And I said, I think I got Bell's palsy. I can only smile on one side of my face and it looks like I've had a stroke. And he told me what steroid to get over there. So we did. And I guess it helped a little bit. It has slowly gotten better. Most people don't notice it in real life. I thought, you know, what am I to learn from this? And one of life's little ironies, I used to do a bit with a rubber mask that had a smile on one side and a frown on the other. It was a Don Post mask, and I do it as the great Lounge-ini. And I noticed when I turned to one side, it looked like he was smiling, and when I turned to the other way, it looked like he was frowning. So I could get two expressions out of a static mask. And I've designed masks for shows. Sometimes I'll be hired to teach dancers a clown routine for a circus or something. I still come up with clown routines all the time. And I always made those masks asymmetrical. So now I had this face that was asymmetrical. And I thought, well, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you funnier. When I look at old footage of myself and I go, oh, I think it was a little over the top. It was a little too animated. I look at the expressions now and they're funnier. I've had people come up after the show and say, I love those expressions you make. We were in Bogota and there was a statue act in the show. He would watch us every night from the wing. And he said, boy, you remind me of that guy in Young Frankenstein. I'm going, oh, no. And I'm telling Sherry, it's Marty Feldman. She goes, no, it's Gene Wilder. And he said, when Gene Wilder is the good looking one, you know you're in trouble. And sure enough, it was Marty Feldman. And it's because when I'm really into the act and doing it, one eye looks bigger than the other. I look even more pitiful during some of the things. So, I don't have a Hollywood smile. But I've got character. Character comes with age.
Maybe you're the living version of the comedy and tragedy masks.
I am, exactly. I am.
That speaks to theater, everything from drama to the comedy and the humor. And in some ways, what you and Sherry are doing in the act, there's a truth underneath that. There is a tragedy of this guy desperate to keep his wife interested or attracted.
And that's our logo, is the comedy and tragedy, except I used to be the comedy and Sherry was the tragedy. And now maybe it's the other way around. But on our backdrop, the two masks at the top are us. And this did happen in Athens. And it did happen after I'd gone to the Temple of Zeus and taken a pebble off the ground and put it in my pocket. And then that night, my face turned into the comedy tragedy. So years later, we went back to Athens. And don't you think I didn't return that rock to the Temple of Zeus? So I think I went to bed praying one night, dear Lord, please make me funnier. And I was smited. It's weird, but what are you going to do? It's part of the humanity. It's part of the humanity that comes across.
I'm glad to hear that your attitude about it is good. We are dealt cards sometimes that we have to play the hand. When I moved out of Mandeville, Louisiana, it was on the rebound from Katrina, and I never saw that tragedy happening to my community or to my family, and everybody ended up somewhere else and getting back on their feet in terms of the big picture, But many, many people there lost it all. You do get a retrospective that in some ways you're lucky to survive any of those things.
Yeah. Sherry's from Alexandria, Louisiana. And during Katrina, we went down there and worked at some of the shelters and stuff. Not doing our act, just me doing magic for the kids and stuff like that. What doesn't kill you makes you funnier. I firmly believe that.
Yes. I like running away from the stuff that could kill me. That's my motto. Let me ask you about the book. You have this great book out, and it's really for magicians, I think, because it's all the close-up magic tricks and the things that you've developed, and even some things that you have road-tested and other things that are just inspirational ideas for folks to run with. I was intrigued by the back part of the book that weren't the how-to tricks, but that were the stories and how to develop your character and what you need to do to move on stage. And you had a little area called eccentrics, which was just gags and bits of business. How long did it take you to assemble this giant book?
Well, we really worked hard on it for a year. But a lot of those eccentrics columns, the cartoons, they came out of my work with Juggle Magazine and Magic Magazine. I used to have a monthly column in those. So I cultivated them from that and tweaked them and added some new ones. So some of that, I've often written down my routines and a few of the essays I had published before that I rewrote and added to, done lectures on character. So I drew from that for that section, writing some of the war stories around the world in 40 years. A lot of people know us from different things. My circus friends know me as a clown. My magic friends know me as a magician. My juggler friends know me as a juggler. So this kind of told everybody a little bit more about us. A lot of people don't even know all the shows that we've done abroad and things. We're known in different circles. We're known here in Vegas, but we're also known in England and Spain or France or Australia or New Zealand. We've been in the trenches a long time. We've put on the miles. So I felt like, yeah, we'll tell some of those stories.
Well, you say put on the miles, but it's a very adventurous life and eye-opening to go to these other cultures and to be a part of bringing joy and laughter and hope to places. I mean, you've been in some very remote places of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. We lived in South Africa for a year and a half. We lived in Malaysia 6 or 8 months doing a show there. We lived in Australia a year and a half.
Do you have any hot tips, like pro tips for somebody who would live a life of travel?
Yeah. Well, it's not as easy as it used to be. And they're not the long-term production shows that we used to do. You know, I don't tell people to go into show business. I don't tell them to be an actor. Americans, I'd say, you know, the most commercial thing is to be more of a stand-up kind of performer. There's not a lot of work for a silent act unless it's really top level and you're willing to work abroad. So show business is always changing. I don't want to be the one to tell somebody to go into it because I know how difficult it is. But if you want to sleep in your own bed at night, then be as versatile as possible, have your verbal material and be able to be well-rounded, be a general practitioner, be able to do close-up and stage and strolling. And
how about anything for a simple travel tip? Like I remember hearing some old broadcaster saying, always sleep on the bed that's the furthest from the phone, because traveling salesmen would sit on the edge of the bed by the phone and make their calls, and that would leave like a half dent on that side of the bed. And somebody also talked about traveling with a wooden clothespin so that you can close those chintzy drapes from that light coming in.
There's a whole book of these called Road Warriors that Randy Pryor wrote, and I contributed some stuff to that. Make sure your carry-on bag is black, so that if it doesn't fit under the seat in front of you, it'll be behind your legs and in such a way that when they walk down the aisle, they won't see it. But your other bags that are checked, make them bright so you can see them on the tarmac. We travel like tourists, even though we travel with 200 pounds of props with us. It's still like tourists. I joke that I take the jokers out of the deck to make it a little lighter. Our prop case is at exactly like 49.9 pounds. It's exactly right. A prop table I designed has to break down to fit in that. I cut a few inches off of a cane, so it'll fit into the trunk diagonal. So just real practical things. George Carl traveled the world with one suitcase. That was it. And barely a change of clothes. The phrase that will get you around the world is, do you speak English? That's all. That's all you need. You know, do you speak English? Because everywhere you go, somebody's going to go, a little bit, you know? So that will get you around the world. Thank goodness the world speaks broken English.
Well, yes, lucky for us all. Well, I appreciate your trip around the world in this conversation today and sharing some of your insights and inspiration. You are one of the hardest working guys, and everything you take on, I think you try to do it to the best of your ability. That always impressed me in your artwork and in your visuals and tricks and costume. And I just wish you and Sherry continued success as you carry on.
One last thing to babble about. That's one great thing about show business, the meritorious aspect of it. It doesn't matter where you come from. We've made friends with people everywhere. We found people we can relate to, even when it's a country that we're supposed to be at odds with. That's happening up at the top with the politics. The actual people, it's a cliche, but we are more alike than different. And performers are just kind of a glimmer, a peek into that aspect of humanity.
I think this is a testament to you, Charlie, because I think that you know that really, aside from the tricks, what your trade is humor, heart, and humanity. So you make people see a reflection of themselves in your character.
Yeah, connecting. It's all about connecting with people and getting the people to connect with each other. When we're all laughing at the same thing or applauding the same thing, we're on the same page. And that commonality is intoxicating. That's why we go to shows.
Well, if you want to find out more, go to charliefrye.com. Fry has an E on the end, F-R-Y-E. And you can see lots of these videos and tricks and stunts and just all the crazy feats of daring do that Charlie's capable of.
Well, thanks, Pat. Thank you. Best to you and your family.
All right. Cheers, Charlie. Thanks. Thanks for listening. Take a moment to subscribe and we will hold your seat for more creative conversation and a weekly spark of inspiration. Our show is produced by Sweetwood Creative in Austin, Texas, with sound editing and crafty co-producing by Tucker Hazel. The original music theme was created and sung by Maya Sharp, with additional production support and sanity provided by Diane Johansson, Tony Deo, and Tanner Dykstra. Please feel free to dash off a review on social media to help grow this creative community. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, or visit our website at creativityincaptivity.fun. You heard that right, .fun. As in, that was so fun. Bye for now.
La, 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 la. Staring.